Not long after my mother's death, the curtain rose on a new act, heralded by secret conferences between my brothers from which I was firmly excluded, clearly indicating that I was the object of their conspiracy. The desirability of sending me away to boarding school had never been in doubt, only the means of paying for it. Somehow a benefactor was found, negotiations with the school concluded, and soon I was informed that the Dragon School, Oxford, had accepted me as a pupil. I suspect the fact that my four brothers had been already to the school helped the situation. The Dragon School was essentially a civilized place, in contrast to Wellington College, where I went later. It was a mixed school where early in its history girls won the same rights as boys. It fostered a collective spirit bringing out the best in work, play and the arts. I was kitted out with the very minimum required by the school clothing list, which my elder sister packed into an ancient family trunk whose locks had long since fallen apart and which was now secured with an old rope washing line. My sister, who at the time was no more than 15 or 16 years old and about the same proportions as myself, could not resist borrowing the more desirable items of clothing for her own use. She was passing through a yachting phase and my white flannels and cricket shirts disappeared almost as soon as they were purchased. To make up weight and volume it was necessary to ballast the trunk, and I could easily arrive back at school with a motley collection of old bras, pants and vests, much to the embarrassment of both matron and myself. With the advent of boarding school, I underwent a complete metamorphosis of behavior and character. Until then I had lived and survived in a largely adult world. What companions I had made of my own age were acquaintances of the moment, picked up casually off the streets, whose games were off, physical and generally antisocial. There was little in my home to attract boys of my own background, and even if I managed to smuggle them through the front door, their subsequent discovery and reception was so hostile that our house was soon blacklisted. At boarding school this mold had to be turned inside out, as I now had to adapt myself very rapidly to a children's society with a completely different set of rules and code of behavior. A whole new territory of toys and games opened up and I quickly discovered an appetite for possessions such as model trains and lead soldiers, the like of which I had not come across before. It was not long before I began to enjoy the settled and secure routine at boarding school, so much so that the normal schoolboy's attitude to it became reversed. I looked forward to returning to school after the holidays and viewed the approach of the holidays with dread. To avoid ragging, it was important to conform to the pattern, so I learned to be extremely secretive about my home life. To explain the lack of letters, food parcels and visitors, I invented a guardian who lived in India and whom I saw only very infrequently. This appeared to satisfy my cronies but also earn me a considerable amount of sympathy, indeed, so much that I became very popular as a spare boy, always available to be taken out to lunch. There was nothing worse at school than failure to produce a friend at the appropriate time. By visiting parents or invited home for a week in the holidays. During the holidays, Terence left me more and more alone, although I was not entirely free from assaults upon my person and dignity. However, he was discovering the effectiveness of the latter, and for one punishment I was dispatched back to the Dragon School without any pocket money at all, and even now I cringe at the humiliation of having to confess to the master in charge that I had no cash to hand in and then being lent a shilling by him to last me the term. To be an orphan was bad enough, to be a pawn was awful. Boarding school introduced me to its own peculiar activities, the fiercest of which were cold baths and organized games, both probably instituted for the same purpose of damping the ardor of young male spirits and bodies. There was an almost animal ferocity about the way we were rudely awakened from innocent sleep and driven like sheep into the ice-cold dip of a large lead-lined trough in the schoolhouse, as though to cleanse any dirty thoughts lurking under the bedclothes. Dirty thoughts were not entirely driven from my mind. My first initiation with raw sex was with one of the succession of maids, since wages of 10 shillings a week did not buy their loyalty for very long. She was not a bad girl, about 17 years old, from the country, with a red face and large hands chapped and ingrained from endless treks to frozen coal cellars. One evening when the rest of my family were out, she came into my room with a set expression on her face, sat on the bed and silently slid her hand under the bedclothes to hold and fondle my penis. In retrospect, I suspect she had acquired a boyfriend and wanted to find out what a male organ was like. The whole exercise was conducted in total silence except for a quickening of her breathing, but the poor creature could not have learned much since my member was still far too young to rise. Nevertheless, I remember it as a not unpleasant feeling. This first brush with sex led to my second, and this time with a member of my own sex. During my first year at the Dragon School, I was boasting one day in the house playroom about this sexual adventure, embellished with a few fantasies of my own, to a spellbound circle of 9-year-olds, and I was so engrossed that I failed to notice an older boy listening intently a few yards away. After prep that evening, the same boy cornered me and forced me into a lavatory where, dropping his trousers, he demanded to be shown exactly what the maid had done to me. This taught me an important lesson about boarding school dash and never brag in front of older boys. The boys at school talked about girls, and I began to get the general idea that they had something to do with the first ripples of desire stirring between my loins. Discussions were conducted furtively in the dormitories after lights out or in the farthest corners of the playroom removed from the suspicious eyes of masters, so there was obviously something very naughty about girls. There were plenty of girls at the Dragon School, mostly daughters of Oxford academics, and we were encouraged to treat them as members of the same race. One of them played on the same rugby football team as myself, much to the complete bewilderment of our opponents. Tucking her skirt into her knickers, she would set off with the ball tucked under her chubby arm, down the touchline, chased by a pack of small boys trying to decide whether to tackle her or not. She was a large, hearty young lady with no inhibitions at all. We became quite friendly and, indeed, she was kind enough one day after a match to lower her knickers behind the changing room and show me what was underneath, but that was all. I was definitely not allowed to touch. Having failed the common entrance examination to Winchester twice, I moved on from Dragon School to Wellington College in 1934. Where my brother Rupert was a housemaster, known to us as a tutor. After the Dragon School, Wellington was a cultural shock. While the Dragon School sought to bring out the best talents in the young, Wellington seemed to encourage their worst vices. At my prep school, boys were treated as individuals. At my public school, they were regimented into a system for producing the right type of candidate for Sandhurst or Woolwich. The stark Victorian red brick buildings rising out of an uninspiring heathland looked at first sight like a prison, and it is not surprising that the inmates occasionally acted like prisoners. I was flogged 3 times in my first term by the head of my house, who was also captain of boxing, on the last occasion for no other misdemeanor than being too tough, which I felt really was the pot calling the kettle black. I arrived at Wellington at the end of a very bad era. The school was a breeding ground for beating, bullying and homosexuality. Boys were deemed all right, but girls were definitely off limits. Cold baths, classes starting at 7 o'clock in the morning, PT before breakfast followed by a vigorous routine of work, sport and innumerable officers training corps, OTC, parades were designed to keep the sexual devils at bay, but the complete suppression of natural sex together with the frequent beatings of young boys by older boys created just the atmosphere the authorities were trying to avoid. There was a cozy small circle of homosexual masters and their followers, boys easily recognized by their prettiness, carefully waved hair and effeminate manners. They minced around in a group and survived only under the protection of their mentors. Some years later, I met an old Wellingtonian army captain who explained to me the extent of this club, whose tentacles spread far beyond Wellington into the dark labyrinths of the universities and Sandhurst, and the results of which surfaced many years later, as the spies emerged from the woodwork. While I was at Wellington, the army was seriously being considered as a suitable career for me by my guardians, but this dream came to an abrupt end a year or so later. A number of us had found a very good use for the core rifles, using a blank cartridge to launch a missile, pencil or acorn, quite a distance with some force. I tried this on a field day when Marlborough College were acting as the enemy and unfortunately shot one of their boys through the cheek, inflicting a deep wound. I was summarily reduced to the ranks. Hardly a great testimonial for a military career. During those years my brother Terence got married and the Sanderson Road house was sold. As the tide of family life, such as it was, went out, my other brothers and sisters drifted off and I was left stranded on the beach during the holidays. For the next 4 years I led a nomadic life, shunting from one accommodation to another. This meant that I never amassed personal possessions which were not easily transportable, such as a bicycle. I was occasionally forced to stay with Terence when all other bolt holes had been filled, but he hardly received me with open arms after years of mutual antipathy and dislike. By this time he was editor of the Newcastle Journal and lived in a substantial residence in posh Gosforth, a suburb of Newcastle upon Tyne. Gosforth is still posh in the north, and if you say that you live there it is like saying that you live in Belgrave Square if you live in London. Not that this rubbed off on me, since I was relegated to the role of an unwanted brother and allocated a small attic at the top of the house. Except when locked in combat with Terence, I was seldom invited into the more comfortable parts of the house when he was present. I soon became too large and strong for him to apply the physical means to overpower me, so he relied on carefully articulated verbal abuse instead, something at which he was masterly and was still just as frightening. I believe it was Beverly Nichols who wrote that following his father's bullying as a boy, he plotted how he could dispose of him. Certainly I plotted for some years how I might bring about Terence's downfall and humiliation. Wellington being an army school, its rigorous routine no doubt prepared boys for the worst. There is a tale of a naval captain who, on being finally released from a Japanese POW camp, was asked by reporters on his return to England whether his experience was as bad as had been made out. The captain replied, "Well, it was no worse than my 4 years at Dartmouth. I felt much the same about Wellington. I survived for two principal reasons. The first was the protective blanket thrown around me by my brother, and the second was that I had already learned the rough tricks of the trade around the back streets of Newcastle. When I arrived at Wellington I hardly knew Rupert. He had remained a shadowy figure in my early years. Though a classical scholar at Winchester, he had taken modern languages at Oxford. Winchester would have suited him much better than Wellington, where I always suspected he was a misfit. As a progressive, he spent his whole life fighting the army tradition of education. At 26 years of age he was a very young and popular tutor, and I got to know him much better when I joined his form to learn German grammar from a textbook he had written himself. I started off ragging him but was quickly put in my place, allocated a desk by myself in a corner of the classroom and firmly called hoarsely. Rupert's classroom was a friendly place and hardly prepared me for the move next term into a form of terror ruled by the Hun, a squat fat man whose eyes glinted with lust behind steel-rimmed spectacles as he hypnotized his victims like a stoat facing a rabbit. He enjoyed beating boys in his study, lowering their trousers first and feeling their bare bottoms after each stroke. The Hun was recalled with fear by many generations of Wellingtonians, and when he was finally caught in delicto flagranti he hurriedly left Wellington under a cloud, only to give the same medicine to generations of Oakhamians. So I climbed up the school hierarchy quite steadily, first as a fag, then after a spell in no man's land finally joining the elite as a prefect with five fags on call, of which Christopher Lee was one. This no doubt preparing him well for his later roles as Dracula. At Wellington College all the privileges fell to the giants of the playing fields. On a Saturday, for example, if you achieved a college colour for rugby football you were certainly a prince, if not a king, for the day, with the little velvet cap with its gold tassel perched perilously on the back of your head, all the buttons of your jacket undone and hands firmly dug into your trouser pockets, both against the rules. You could stride arrogantly through the quadrangles, scattering the folks in your path, and even school prefects could not put a halt to such splendid progress. I won college colors for rugby, hockey and swimming and joined the swells. But it was not enough, and as the clouds of war built up ominously on the horizon, I became increasingly restless to be gone. I began to plot my escape seriously at the beginning of the summer term of 1939 and wrote to Alfred Holt, the chairman of the Blue Funnel Line, whose son and daughter I had known quite well at the Dragon School, requesting a job on one of his ships. This letter was written more out of bravado than with the expectation of a reply, so imagine my surprise a few days later when I received a letter from him telling me that if I presented myself at his office in a fortnight's time, he would consider taking me on one of his ships. I immediately announced my intention of leaving. I do not think either my tutor or my brother believed me, but as I had already announced the news to my friends, I was stuck with the decision. So exactly a week later, just as the school announced that I was to be captain of swimming for the summer term, I walked out of Wellington. 3. Escape to sea. I thankfully left this dark and miserable chamber. In sharp contrast, I now entered a room, light and airy, filled with Spartan furniture, which seemed to grow more substantial as I walked through it. This is the overture to the drama which follows. I went to sea as a callow schoolboy, cocky and arrogant, and returned 6 months later as a man ready to face the Holocaust ahead. In December, 1938, I had begun a schoolboy's diary of the events which caused such an upheaval, and I now quote from it verbatim, Thursday 25th of May, 1939. On leaving college, boys sell their room by auction, so after tea I announced I was selling mine that afternoon. It was quite a good sale on the whole, and buying was reasonable dash enough to pay my tips and train fare to Liverpool. Some boys came to buy, others just for amusement and others to amuse. Chopping, a young fag, and his gang were of the latter class, and they bought all my crockery merely for the pleasure of dropping it on my head. At these auctions, everybody sits around the study on the wooden walls looking down on the wretched auctioneer. Any rate, I got rid of a lot of unnecessary junk such as pens, geometry sets, old novels, and pictures handed down from one generation of boys to another. I offered my very old carpet for sale and it stuck at sixpence, but when I happened to mention that it had belonged to Johnston, who had been head of college, and captain of nearly everything, the price soared up to 3 shillings and it was knocked down to a junior fag who had never even heard of Johnston but had been caught up in the frantic bidding. Friday 26th of May, 1939. I woke early this morning to a glorious day, my last at school. The quadrangle outside my room was bathed in sunshine and not even a breeze stirred the foliage of the copper beech that stood in the middle of it, guarding the chapel. As the college clock struck 7, 2 fellow prefects, Chris and Derek, appeared on the scene and dragged me along to the bathroom where they ceremoniously ducked me in my last compulsory cold bath, much to the amusement of the fags who inhabit the bathroom at that ungodly hour and who never suspected the prefects capable of such hilarity. Half an hour later, Charteris, the head of dormitory, brought everyone along and I was cheered in the customary manner and had to make a short speech. Many times had I cheered others, but it was unreal and dreamlike to be actually cheered myself. I think my dormitory regarded me as a queer sort of fish who did unsuspected and eccentric things sometimes. I didn't go into breakfast as a few odd jobs still remained to be completed. At 8 o'clock, my train was due to leave Crowthorne at 20 minutes past. College came out of breakfast, and before I finally made my departure, I shook hands with the whole of my dormitory. Chris and Derek promised to spread a rumor that I had been sacked for having an affair with Matron, as if I could get beyond her large mustache. So, dressed in an old tweed coat, grey flannels, and carrying a small bag, I set off through the quads, followed by a battery of stairs. A young lad called Harcourt, with nickname Flop, insisted on carrying my bag halfway and pumped me with hundreds of questions. I really think he imagined I'd got the boot. However, I left him on big side the main rugby football pitch, promising to send him a postcard of bailing bells in straw skirts from Hawaii. Walking across big side, I suddenly felt very lonely, and when I turned round and saw those familiar red buildings bathed in the sun, I longed to turn back, but it was a useless thought. The train left Growth on 2 minutes late. I had been on the same run many times before, and the engine was affectionately known as the Growth on Express. We always felt schizophrenic about Southern Railway. Going back to college, they always traveled too fast and were too dangerous. Returning home, they were too slow and too safe. Wednesday, 31st of May, 1939. I can't imagine why I have left the secure routine of school to face a totally new and uncertain future. If I can't get a job with the Blue Funnel Line, I shall be up to my neck in trouble. Just after lunch, I caught a bus into Liverpool and walked into India Buildings, a large block just across from the Mersey River. I felt very small in this vast gilded palace with its marble floors. People scurried around the lobby, clerks in their white stiff collars clutching bundles of files, typists in silk stockings giggling amongst themselves. I was whisked in a lift up to the 7th floor, where I inquired of a bespectacled gentleman presiding behind a wooden counter, "Mr. Holt?" It was as if I had asked to see God. Taking a few seconds to recover his composure, he disappeared behind a green baize door. I imagined he would reappear and tell me to go away and come back another day. Not so. He returned 15 minutes later, when he led me into a side room. A middle-aged man in an untidy blue suit was standing there, and I thought he was another clerk. He held out his hand. "How do you do, Horsley?" he said. "I am Alfred Holt. I believe you know my children?" He sat down and motioned me to sit at his side. Meanwhile, another person had come into the room and, without a word, sat at the table with a pile of dossiers in front of him. I explained my predicament to Mr. Holt and the imperative need for me to go to sea. Mr. Holt immediately asked me the question, "Have you the permission of your guardian?" "Yes," I replied, crossing my fingers under the table. He then turned to his clerk and said, "Give me a file on boats leaving Liverpool in the next week or so." While he was looking at the file, I had a chance to study him. He was a fine-looking man with tired but penetrating blue eyes. He hardly needed the file, as he seemed to know all about the boats, when they arrived, when they left, the names of his captains and officers. "Ah yes," he finally said, "here's a boat leaving for the East on Saturday. Would that suit you?" I immediately replied, "Yes." "All right," he said, "you will be a deck boy at a salary of 1 shilling per month. You will work and live with the crew, but I will put you under the charge of the midshipmen, and you have your meals with them and the officers." I didn't realize the significance of the shilling a month until a few days later. "Oh yes," he said, "I will give you a letter for the captain to the effect that you may get on and off the boat and rejoin another one at any time." I suspect this was some kind of insurance for the company, but it was nevertheless very decent of him. He got up, held out his hand and said, "Goodbye, Horsley," and continued, "If I was 20 years younger, I would come with you. Now you can go and see Mr. Miller." Mr. Miller turned out to be a white-haired old man in a tweed jacket who appeared to be the general factotum. He proceeded to tell me a bit about the Blue Funnel Line. "We are," he said, with pride, "an old-fashioned family shipping line, mainly running cargo to the Far East, but some of our ships do take a few passengers. The ships are all driven by coal and are easily recognizable by the tall blue funnel. You will be signed on the TSS, twin screw ship, cargo boat, the Cyclops, carrying a mixed bag of heavy machinery, cotton goods and tin trays to China and Japan. She will be calling at Gibraltar, Port Said, Aden and Penang in Malaya to bunker before going on to Shanghai and Yokohama." He went on to explain that almost everywhere the ship docked was part of the Great British Empire, except China and Japan. We had enormous possessions around the world, in America, India, Africa, Australia, and colonies in the Indian and Pacific Oceans. The Blue Funnel Line served this empire, taking finished goods from England and bringing back the raw materials. I was suitably impressed. Finally, he said, come back tomorrow and you can sign on the articles of the ship and I will introduce you to the midshipman. I left India Buildings walking on air. Thursday, 1st of June, 1939. Today I signed on the articles of the Cyclops as a deck boy. I was introduced to the midshipmen who were supposed to keep an eye on me, Messrs. Roxby, Frost, Elliot and Raymond. Roxby was a tall boy with hard blue eyes and a sharp tongue. Frost was a thick-set Australian with a mop of curly brown hair, and with kind eyes. In contrast to Roxby's, he seemed a pleasant sort of boy. Elliot, on the other hand, looked rat-like, a medium tall boy with straight smooth hair and shifty eyes. Raymond was a pleasant but obviously hard-headed Welshman, obstinate looking too, and his companions called him Taffy. So after a last-minute shopping spree I returned to my pub for the last night in England. Birkenhead that evening was full of the talk of the submarine Thetis. She had sunk just outside Liverpool Harbour on a test dive and was stuck on the bottom of the sea. She was crammed full of dockyard workers. Rumours ran like wildfire. One tram conductor told me that everyone had been saved, another that they were all lost. 12 midnight saw me in a fish and chip shop about a quarter of a mile from my ship. There was about 10 other people in the shop besides myself and two girls behind the counter. There was only one conversation, Thetis. The word hung from everyone's lips, it was written in their eyes, dull and sad. They were all working class people, men with scarves for collars and black pointed shoes covered in dirt and oil. They all seemed to know at least one of the men trapped in the submarine. The girl behind the counter walked over to a cheap-looking radio set and turned it on. A voice quietened us. There is not much hope left for the men on the submarine, the voice said. All is being done for those entombed in the Thetis, but I am afraid the air is running out rapidly. Saturday, 3rd of June, 1939. This morning I went on board. Everyone was so busy that they took no notice of me, so I leaned over the rail and watched everyone else working. The noise and bustle on the deck was incredible. We were due to leave at 10 o'clock, but in fact it was 10:30 before the pilot came aboard. The Cyclops left the wharf at exactly 11 o'clock. It was an exciting business. The first mate stood on the poop, from time to time waving his arms and shouting. The pilot was on the bridge, megaphone in hand, and beside him stood the captain looking very serious and very much the captain. A whistle seemed to be the signal for activity to begin. The gangway was drawn up, ropes were cast loose, smoke poured from the funnel. Two thick cables were thrown to two waiting tugs which caught them and proceeded to pull us out of the wharf. There were a lot of ships all along the wharves, some quite deserted, others full of life and like ourselves about to embark on a journey. There was one black and derelict, a symbol of a shattered past. There was a smart Japanese liner whose officers were sprucely dressed in white. I feel horrible lonely, I wish I could turn back. I seem to be alone in the world about to go thousands of miles, it's my own fault. I chose this course. I suppose this is homesickness, but leaving Liverpool with the wharf getting fainter and fainter, and surrounded by strange faces, I would give anything for my room at Wellington and a few friends. There's a race of men that don't fit in, a race that can't stay still, so they break the hearts of kith and kin, and they roam the world at will. They range the field and they rove the flood, and they climb the mountain's crest, theirs is the curse of the gypsy blood. And they don't know how to rest. John Masefield. It was about 2 hours after leaving the dock that we saw signs that something was amiss. A squat destroyer closely followed by a small trawler steamed by on our port bow. We arrived on the scene by tea time, which was forgotten in the excitement. About a mile or so away to starboard we saw the cluster of ships, some naval and some commercial steamers like ourselves, all taking part or trying to help in the grim drama below the sea. From a distance it looked like a harmless cluster of toadstools outlined against the sky in a field of blue. It was anything but harmless, a sinister scene, but at the same time a macabre and fascinating one, for in the middle of that cluster death had struck not once but 100 times. We could be of no use, so we steamed away slowly and regretfully from that sad spot.